That old dust storm killed my baby, but it can't kill me, Lord, and it can't kill me. That old dust storm killed my family, but it can't kill me, Lord, and it can't kill me. That old landlord, and it got my homestead, but it can't get me, Lord, and it can't get me. That old dry spell killed my crop, boys, but it can't kill me, Lord, and it can't kill me. That old tractor got my home, boys, but it can't get me, Lord, and it can't get me. That old tractor run my house down, but it can't get me down, and it can't get me. That old pawn shop got my furniture, but it can't get me, Lord, and it can't get me. That old highway's got my relatives, but it can't get me, Lord, and it can't get me. That old dust might kill my wheat, boys, but it can't kill me, Lord, and it can't kill me. I have weathered many a dust storm, but it can't get me, boys, and it can't kill me. That old dust storm, well, it blowed my barn down, but it can't blow me down, and it can't blow me down. That old wind might blow this world down, but it can't blow me down, it can't kill me. That old dust storm killed my baby, but it can't kill me, Lord, and it can't kill me.
62, when the Kennedy administration demanded that Premier Nikita Khrushchev dismantle the missile sites the Soviet Union were building in Cuba. The U.S. imposed a naval blockade on Cuba, and Soviet ships tried to break it several times. In addition, the Soviets shot down an American spy plane. There was genuine fear that a nuclear war might be imminent until back-channel negotiations succeeded. Today I'm talking with Washington Post reporter Michael Dobbs, author of 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. And later in the hour, Brown University professor Jim Blight, who's been researching and writing on the subject for most of his career. Michael Dobbs wrote 1 Minute to Midnight, his account of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in 2008. He is a veteran foreign correspondent who spent most of his career covering the collapse of communism. But half a century ago, communism was on the march, and Comrade Khrushchev was pushing closer and closer to the American mainland. 51 years ago today marked the beginning of the famous 13 days in October, when the Soviet Union placed nuclear missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles from Florida, and some 6,000 miles from direct control in Moscow.
The two main actors, Kennedy and Khrushchev, what insights did you come to about these two men as you studied them and wrote about them?
It would be hard to think of two people more opposite than Kennedy and Khrushchev. And Khrushchev was the bumpkin peasant from the Ukraine who grew up dirt poor. He'd experienced World War II. He'd clawed his way to the top of this totalitarian political system through his command of bureaucratic infighting. To look at, he was not smooth. He was a rough peasant type. Kennedy was the opposite. Kennedy was born to one of the wealthiest families in the United States, a life of privilege. And he'd been elected as a democratic leader of the world's largest democracy. So they're completely different characters. But what is extraordinary in the missile crisis is, as though although these two people were separated by an ocean and their backgrounds were so different, there came a point when they were really on the same side, that they both became very scared by the forces that they had unleashed, and they were both in their different ways trying to bring the crisis to an end. And I think the real drama is not so much the confrontation between Khrushchev and Kennedy, but the fact that they've both unleashed their respective war machines, which have got a kind of momentum and dynamic of their own, and they're neither of them completely control their own military machines. So they're both racing against time to save the world from a nuclear catastrophe.
They had had a meeting in Vienna, a meeting that went badly for Kennedy. And first of all, why did it go badly for Kennedy?
Well, that was in 1961. And in fact, it's become a topic that Barack Obama is saying, well, we have to deal with America's enemies. And the Republicans are saying we have to be very careful before we talk to them. And they're citing this precedent. Essentially, Kennedy went into the meeting not very well prepared. He thought he could charm Khrushchev. Khrushchev, in his standard operating procedure, was to bully and bluster and intimidate his, both his Kremlin rivals and his superpower rivals. So they got into the meeting, and Khrushchev started bullying Kennedy and talking about using nuclear weapons. I think it was Macmillan said later about Kennedy that it was like Hitler talking to Chamberlain at Munich. Or LBJ was also very scathing about Kennedy's performance. He said that the poor little fellow, as he put it, as he described Kennedy, was scared out of his wits. Kennedy himself was critical of his own performance.
Did that lay the groundwork for the crisis by letting Khrushchev think that Kennedy was a pushover?
It's difficult to say if it led directly to the Soviet decision to deploy missiles in Cuba. I think it's fair to say that Khrushchev's first impressions of Kennedy were not very flattering to Kennedy, and he did consider him weak. So it may have played some role, but there were other factors involved as well. I think that Khrushchev simply saw this as a way of killing many birds with one stone, that he would defend the Cuban Revolution, he would even the nuclear balance of power between the two superpowers, because at the time we had many more missiles that could hit the Soviet Union than they had that could hit the United States. And by deploying his missiles in Cuba, he not only defended the Cuban Revolution, he also, in a sense, evened up the balance of nuclear power between the two superpowers. And he was also just generally upset that the United States had deployed missiles around the periphery of the Soviet Union, particularly in Turkey and Italy. And he would look at, he was a very emotional man. And there's stories of him at his seaside resort on the Black Sea, looking out across the Black Sea and imagining American missiles in Turkey. And he thought that he needed, he wanted simply to get even with the Americans.
And you say when the missiles were first discovered, the immediate reaction wasn't chilling fear, it was belligerence.
On the American side?
Yes.
I think that's true. I mean, the first instinct of, particularly of Bobby Kennedy, who was a more emotional type than his brother, was the commies have tricked us. We're going to get our own back somehow. And on the first day, had they had to take a decision the first day, the decision would probably have been to bomb the missile sites as a prelude to invasion, because having done that, you'd have probably killed Soviets, created chaos in Cuba. It would have led to an invasion in the long term. Fortunately, from Kennedy's point of view, he had he was able to keep the discovery of Soviet missiles secret for a week. So he had a week to think about what he was going to do before he took his decision. And in the end, he decided not to bomb. He decided to implement a blockade instead.
Did anything in particular stand out to you as indicative of how much pressure there was on Kennedy to immediately react militarily?
Well, we have records of his meetings with his military people, and including LeMay. Curtis LeMay, the cigar-chomping commander and creator of the Strategic Air Command, who he and various other military leaders essentially wanted to exploit America's military superiority over the Soviet Union and take the opportunity of bombing the hell out of the Soviet Union. As LeMay put it once, we've got the bear by the testicles, and we should twist them as hard as we can.
Curtis LeMay was known as Bombs Away LeMay.
And LeMay, when he discovered that they would not bomb the missile sites, that they would impose a quarantine or blockade, he said this is as bad as the appeasement at Munich. Practically all the military, the top uniformed military, were against the idea of blockade. They thought there should be military action. So there was quite a bit of pressure on Kennedy.
And words like appeasement had deeper meaning for Kennedy.
Well, you're right, because Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, had been the British U.S. ambassador to Britain in the late 30s and was regarded as an appeaser. So when LeMay throws the word appeasement at Kennedy in the White House, he is sort of very unsubtly reminding the president about the history, the rather shameful history of his own family.
And was there a parallel discussion going on in Moscow?
There was, except it wasn't as democratic as the discussion here. And I think we also have the Presidium records, Presidium of the Communist Party, who were meeting in the Kremlin, not as detailed as the American records. So we know a little bit about what was happening. Essentially, most other Presidium members took the view that Khrushchev had got us into this mess. It's up to Khrushchev to get us out of it. And so it was very much Khrushchev's show in Moscow.
And did he really seem to realize immediately that that's what he would do? He would take the missiles out?
Well, his initial reaction on the night that he heard that Kennedy was going on television was to think of ways of getting even, perhaps authorize his troops on Cuba to use tactical nuclear weapons, or to hand the missiles over to the Cubans, put Fidel in charge of the missiles. We can imagine where that would have led. But he, I think, fairly quickly took the view that he wanted to find a way out of the crisis, and certainly within 2 or 3 days, he had decided that he would probably have to end up bringing the missiles out, but he was still in a kind of haggling, negotiating mood. He thought he could use them as a bargaining chip. And when he sensed that the Americans were getting a little weaker, he would sort of up his stakes. And it was like two people playing poker with, and it took sort of, because of the communications difficulties between Moscow and Washington, one side would make his move, and then it took 12 hours for the other side to make the move. And, a lot of things could happen in those 12 hours.
Now, how did Castro feel about all this?
Well, Castro, of the three of them, was the most ready to have this develop into a nuclear war. He thought that the Soviets he believed that his Soviet allies enjoyed nuclear superiority over the United States. He was terribly wrong on that. And he was also prepared for a nuclear war on Cuban soil. He thought he could not afford to compromise at all with the Americans, that any compromise was the first step to defeat. He was, and his comrades, were prepared to die and take a large number of their fellow countrymen with them.
I'm speaking with Michael Dobbs about the Cuban Missile Crisis. He wrote about it in his book called 1 Minute to Midnight, and we'll continue just about now in 1962, these 13 days in October, that the world came as close to nuclear war as we ever have. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we're looking back at it today on the program. Right now I'm speaking with Michael Dobbs, who chronicled the drama in his 2008 book, 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. And you let the air out of some of the best-known stories of this period, including the famous back channel involving an American journalist and the KGB station chief in Washington.
A reporter for ABC News called John Scali, who later became U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was meeting with a Soviet official who turned out to be the KGB station chief in Moscow, a man called Feklisov. Together they met in various restaurants around town and hatched a plan to save the world from nuclear war. Scali convinced the Kennedy administration that this was a back channel to Khrushchev. In fact, Khrushchev was completely unaware of what Feklisov was doing, and Feklisov was probably just kind of fishing for information in the traditional KGB manner, and his signals were misinterpreted by Scali. Whether Scali just exaggerated his own role or whether he really believed that this was an important channel, I don't know. But what I do know is that contrary to the myth and to many missile crisis histories, particularly the early ones, it played virtually no role in the final outcome.
And then there was the legendary moment when a Soviet freighter came eyeball to eyeball with American warships and the Soviets blinked.
Right. For any of your listeners who have seen the movie 13 Days, this is features prominently in the movie. Of you actually see the Soviet ships come within sight of the American warships, and the American warships threatening to blow them out of the water, and Kennedy actually on the line from the White House deciding at the last moment not to attack because the Soviet ships have turned around. I think I'm the first researcher who's actually plotted where the Soviet ships were and where the American ships were at the time, and Khrushchev had taken the decision to turn his ships around the previous day. So at the time of the eyeball-to-eyeball moment, as depicted in many missile crisis histories and by Hollywood, about 800 miles of water separated the two navies at that point. And the Soviet ships were headed, or at least the Soviet ships that were carrying missiles, were headed back to the Soviet Union.
There's generally a lot of confusion during the crisis, and you take the long view on it when you say that history is determined not just by the so-called rational actors, like the bureaucrats and generals, but also the irrational actors, people who stumble onto the stage by chance and change the course of history. And U2 pilot Chuck Maltsby became one of the latter. What was his story?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the real risk of war did not come from this direct confrontation between Khrushchev and Kennedy, as symbolized by the eyeball-to-eyeball moment. I think it came from the kind of accidents, unpredictable events that happen almost automatically as soon as you gear up your military machine for war. And a very good example of this was the mission, U2 mission of Captain Maltsby, on October 27th, which became known around the White House as Black Saturday. It was probably the day we became closer to nuclear war than either before or since. And essentially the story is that the Soviets had been testing in the atmosphere. We had routine missions to the North Pole to pick up radioactive samples from the Soviet nuclear tests, which had drifted up to the North Pole from the Soviet nuclear test site. Captain Maltsby was meant to go to the North Pole, collect the samples, and return to Alaska. Instead, he's about 4 or 5 hours out from Alaska when he gets blinded by the Aurora Borealis. And in those days, of course, the navigation systems in planes and U-2s was much cruder than it is these days. They had to navigate by the stars. You couldn't see the stars. So instead of going back to Alaska, he takes a wrong turn somehow, and instead of at the time when he should be back landing at Alsen Air Force Base, he is blundering over the Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the Cold War. He spends 1.25 hours over in Soviet airspace, and I've traced his route in detail, actually runs out of fuel and has to glide back to Alaska. The whole story of how the Strategic Air Command identifies where he is and how they get him back is quite a long saga. But the essential point is that Kennedy and the Pentagon hierarchy didn't even know that this mission was going on at the time. It's one of these kind of unpredictable events, like in the, we've seen many of them in Iraq, of course, and during the Kosovo War, we had the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And the point is, once you go to war, these many things that you never expected can start to happen, and some of them can be very dangerous. And the Maltby case is an example of that.
And on the Soviet side, you point to the commander of one of the four submarines sent into the region as a show of strength and protection for the freighters carrying arms to Cuba.
That's right. And although I said that the Soviet ships turned back, at least the missile-carrying ships, Khrushchev left four submarines in the vicinity of the American blockade. And these weren't ordinary submarines. They were armed with nuclear warheads. Conditions on those submarines were terrible. It had taken them about 3 or 4 weeks to get there. Conditions, it's hard to imagine American sailors putting up with the kind of conditions that the Soviets put up with. Their normal air conditioning systems had failed. It was 140 degrees inside the subs, and they had nuclear weapons to defend themselves. The Americans spent a lot of time tracking down these subs and trying to bring them to the surface, which they did by dropping depth charges on them. Of course, the submarine captains had no idea whether they were depth charges or, you know, what was going on up there. And at one point, on one of the subs, there's a discussion as to whether or not to use the torpedoes against the American destroyer, the nuclear torpedo, against American destroyer who's making their life intolerable. And they're trapped down below, hundreds of feet below the surface of the ocean, not knowing what's happened above, not knowing whether a nuclear war has broken out.
So what happened on the climactic day? This was October 27th, 1962.
Well, a lot of things were happening on this particular day. Originally, I set out to describe in detail just or reconstruct this particular day because I wanted to describe, you know, the day the world came closest to nuclear annihilation. It begins with Fidel Castro convinced that the Americans are about to attack his country, going to the Soviet embassy in Cuba in the middle of the night at 2 in the morning, and writing a letter, a feverish letter to Khrushchev saying, I'm convinced we're about to be attacked, in which case you should use your nuclear weapons against the imperialists and liquidate the imperialists once and for all. He had a rather grandiose idea of the strength of the Soviet nuclear force at that time. So you had Fidel urging Khrushchev to use nuclear weapons. You also had, at the same time, the Soviet commander on Cuba, General Pliev, decided to disperse his nuclear warheads. So they had decided that they would, the first thing they would do if there was an attack on Cuba was they would take out Guantanamo. So they brought up tactical nuclear missiles, cruise missiles, each with a warhead the size of a Hiroshima bomb, 14-kiloton bomb, to the periphery of the Guantanamo naval base. Maltby got lost over the Soviet Union. Another U-2 reconnaissance plane got shot down by the Soviets over Cuba, probably because the Soviets feared that they had discovered their plans for the attack on Guantanamo. Khrushchev sent another letter to Kennedy appearing to up the ante for a deal. He wanted an exchange of Soviet missiles in Cuba for American missiles in Turkey, which was unacceptable. At least a public exchange was unacceptable to Kennedy. At sea in the Caribbean, these depth charges were being dropped on Soviet submarines. So you had at least half a dozen incidents in different parts of the world, any one of which could have resulted in something much more serious. And one of the things that it really struck me was that a president, no matter how well informed he is, cannot possibly keep track of all these things at once. You know, Kennedy only knew half of what was going on. There was so much that he didn't know.
wonder how much Khrushchev knew.
Well, Khrushchev knew even less, because he had his communications with Cuba and his troops on Cuba were much more basic and cruder than the U.S. communication system with their troops. So, and certainly he had no physical control over the nuclear weapons. There were no locks on the weapons. And that's one of the myths that I've sought to dispel, that somehow the commanders-in-chief had control over their own forces. It wasn't true. Command and control are two different things. The commander cannot possibly control everything that happens by his own forces.
And yet they stopped it. It wasn't, you know, you had this big dance going on. But
that's right. Well, remember that both men had been through, experienced the Second World War. And Khrushchev in particular had seen incredible devastation in his own country, and he did not want to go through that again. And he knew that a conventional war was bad enough. And Kennedy as well, he had a sense of the chaotic forces of history, and he knew that he was losing control of events on Saturday. So he was willing to go very far to prevent a nuclear war. So by the Saturday, this culmination of all these events, I think, convinced both leaders that they had to bring the crisis to an end very rapidly, because otherwise something unpredictable could happen.
Did they have the red phone hotline at that time?
They didn't. There was the hotline between the Kremlin and the White House was only installed after the crisis, partly, largely as a result of the crisis. It took 12 hours to get a message from Washington to Moscow, because the former Soviet ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Dobrynin, he tells a story about how they would try to send messages back to Moscow in the middle of the missile crisis, and they would, first of all, they'd have to encode the message, encrypt it in essentially gibberish to anybody else who was reading, then they would write it up in a telegram. They would call Western Union on DuPont Circle. A messenger from Western Union would arrive on a bicycle. He would pick up the precious message from the Soviet embassy and bicycle off, and the Soviet diplomats would see the Western Union messenger bicycling off with their message, trying to defuse a war, and just hope that he wouldn't stop off to chat with his girlfriend or something on the way. Then the message was sent by cable, transatlantic cable, to London, and eventually it would, you know, reach the Kremlin and have to be deciphered. And that process took about 10 to 12 hours often.
So the worst day of the Cold War comes to an end. Khrushchev agrees to take the missiles out, and the Cold War continues for another 30 years.
From 1962 to, I guess, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, that's true. And I think that the missile crisis was, it was a turning point in many ways, because it was the last time that the both sides really thought that, certainly on the American side, that it was possible to win a nuclear war. The Americans enjoyed great strategic advantage at the time of the missile crisis, and there were people who, like LeMay, who thought you could wage and win a nuclear war. During the 60s, there was a massive Soviet buildup, and the two sides became much more equal. So all thought of winning a nuclear war went out the window.
So what do you think of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara's later belief that only luck kept the world from nuclear war over Cuba?
I think there was a large element of luck, but I think it was more than luck, because I think a lot depended on the personalities involved, in particular the personalities of Khrushchev and Kennedy. And although Kennedy made many mistakes, and particularly in his Cuba policy, had been quite provocative to the Russians, when the chips were down, he had everything that could go wrong, partly because he had had his World War II experience. So he understood that things like Maltsby, a U-2 could go missing over the Soviet Union, and he kind of factored that into his decision-making, and it was one of the reasons why on Black Saturday he was willing to go to considerable lengths, including withdrawing U.S. missiles from Turkey, to reach an accommodation with Khrushchev. And one thing we didn't know at the time was that it only came out many years later, was that Bobby Kennedy went to the Soviet embassy on the night of Black Saturday and said, we will after a certain time, withdraw our missiles from Turkey if you withdraw your missiles from Cuba. That deal never became public until 30 or 40 years later.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to be here and great to discuss this with you.
Michael Dobbs. His account of the Cuban Missile Crisis is called 1 Minute to Midnight.
Live from the White House in Washington, the Mutual Broadcasting System brings you an address by President John F. Kennedy. All during the weekend, there has been an atmosphere of crisis here in Washington. Congressional leaders met with the president at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Now with a report to the people. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Next, a transmedia storytelling project about the lessons from those 13 days in October 1962. Jim Blight follows this break.
Sirius XM
Public Radio. 51 years ago, human civilization came as close as it ever has to destroying itself. NATO had placed nuclear missiles in Turkey and Italy and pointed them at the Soviet Union. Moscow decided to even the playing field by placing its own missiles in Cuba, just a few hundred miles from the southern coast of the United States. If President John F. Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev had not resolved their 13-day confrontation, known here as the Cuban Missile Crisis, the resulting nuclear war could have meant the immediate deaths of hundreds of millions of people. After a week of considering his options, Kennedy addressed the nation in what has been called the scariest speech ever given by a president.
My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one can foresee precisely what course it will take or what course or casualties will be incurred. Many months of sacrifice and self-discipline lie ahead, months in which both our patience and our will be tested, months in which many threats and denunciations will keep us aware of our dangers. But the greatest danger of all would be to do nothing. The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere. And we hope around the world, God willing, that goal will be achieved.
Although it's one of the most decisive chapters in human history, the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis are lost on many. The history is hazy to young people and widely misunderstood by those who lived through it. But James Blight has done his best to change that. He's a professor of international affairs at Waterloo University and was one of the historians behind the Errol Morris documentary Fog of War. Blight has employed his captivating brand of scholar meets storyteller in a transmedia history project about the crisis called the Armageddon Letters. First, I asked Professor Blight just how close we came to nuclear war in October of 1962.
I think we came very close, Bob. I don't think we need to consult science fiction anymore or apocalyptic movies, interesting though they may be, because the three leaders directly involved, Fidel Castro, John F. Kennedy, and Nikita Khrushchev, all thought that events were racing out of control and that war was about to break out and that they might not be able to stop it. This is especially true of Kennedy and Khrushchev because they're in charge of these huge nuclear arsenals. Fidel Castro has a somewhat different tale to tell in that he had concluded months before this, 18 months before this, that Cuba was on a trail toward oblivion, that Kennedy would destroy the Cuban government, and that an American attack would involve nuclear weapons. This is long before any nukes were put in Cuba. and that therefore his job as a leader was to prepare the Cuban population to die honorably and in effect to commit national suicide, and in so doing become the salvation of world socialism, that Cuba, instead of being this little podunk nothing, as it had been for so many years, a playground for Americans, rich Americans, Cuba would now become, and this is one of Fidel's phrases, Cuba would become the hinge of the world.
It was a generally accepted narrative of the Cuban Missile Crisis. 13 tense days of negotiation. Khrushchev finally backs down. Kennedy's a hero. What do you challenge in that narrative?
The way we like to tell the standard story is that bad guys put missiles into an empty island where nobody lived, that had no culture, language, or history. We call it Cuba. They parked their missiles there for a few days before the courageous president faced him down and forced him to take them back to the Soviet Union. In sports terms, that would be Kennedy 1, Khrushchev 0, and for basketball fans, Castro gets a DNP for did not play. None of that's actually true. What happened in those 13 days is roughly 2% of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That began in April 1961 with the Bay of Pigs invasion, after which both Khrushchev and Castro concluded that the big invasion, not just sending in the exiles, but the really big invasion, the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, all of that would be coming as soon as Kennedy could muster his troops around Cuba.
Mm-hmm. So what's new to write about this?
Well, with my wife and colleague Janet Lang, we've written 6 books on these so-called 13 days, the Cuban Missile Crisis, published our 7th book, The Armageddon Letters. And what our main purpose was in getting involved again would be to try to produce something that teenagers, college students, people who obviously have no recollection of it, but whose parents might not even have a record. They might have to go to their grandparents to ask about this, if that. But in the process of putting together excerpts from the letters that the leaders sent to each other during this period, especially during the crisis, we discovered for the first time something that we had never noticed before. So after the Bay of Pigs invasion, this begins on the 17th of April, 1961, lasts 72 hours at the outside. Castro's militia wraps everybody up, takes them up to Havana, puts them on trial. It's over. Kennedy is humiliated and so forth. It's a great victory for the Cuban Revolution. Castro arrests 100,000 people on an island of 6.5 million, consolidates the revolution. The Bay of Pigs was a free gift. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to the revolution up to that point. But there's a dark side to this that somehow we missed. After all of these trips to Cuba that we made and all of our interviews with Castro and the others, what we never got was that Castro celebrated the victory, but at the same time he began speaking publicly about Cuba as a martyr nation. And Cuba has a long tradition of this, going back into the Spanish occupation. The Cuban historical figure that Fidel has always identified with is General Antonio Maceo, the great black general, who, when offered negotiating terms by the Spanish, repeatedly turned it down and made no compromise, no surrender, and finally he died fighting the Spanish. But it's this Cuban tradition of equating compromise with humiliation. We're going to get it all or we're not going to get any of it. That Fidel is right down the middle of that tradition. And he begins speaking on April 23rd, 1961, about the coming invasion and attack by the Americans, that we will arm every man, woman, and child. Now, the remarkable thing is Khrushchev wasn't listening and Kennedy wasn't listening. These are public statements made week after week after week. And from my point of view, if either of the leaders of the superpowers had been listening, we'd have had no crisis. If he thought he was putting missiles on an island full of people who thought they were getting ready for martyrdom, he would never have done it. In fact, once he realized it in the heart of the crisis, Khrushchev pulled those suckers out as fast as he could get them out. And if Kennedy had known that Castro thought the American invasion was inevitable, well, he'd have let him know it wasn't. He'd have pulled the ships back because Kennedy didn't want to deal with Cuba anymore. It was just a mess. He wanted to do arms control and comprehensive test ban and U.S.-Soviet relations. And this little, he called it a little pissant country. Cuba was equated with his humiliation at the Bay of Pigs. So we call it the sleepwalk. The superpowers are sleepwalking toward an abyss. They're having a good time jockeying with each other. They're moving around the pawns of the Cold War. And on this island are people who are waiting for the weapons, who are ready to ignite the war that could escalate to Armageddon.
Was it Khrushchev's idea to put missiles in Cuba?
Absolutely. After the Bay of Pigs, this is during the sleepwalk period, but after the Bay of Pigs, Khrushchev immediately realized that we have to save Cuba. I mean, that's how he saw it. We have to be a parent to this child. So they began shipping everything but nuclear weapons and the systems that would support them. I mean, just before the missile crisis, Cuba had become the second most heavily militarized piece of territory on Earth after North Korea. And it had started from nothing, from a standing start, absolute zero, to 43,000 Soviet troops and technicians, to 18 bases around the country, four of which were for the strategic weapons, and so forth. Now, the strategic missile thing comes in when Khrushchev is in Bulgaria in May of 1962. So the movement of troops and material is underway, and he takes a deep breath and thinks, you know, that probably won't be enough. Because his intelligence is telling him that no matter what, how much stuff he pours into Cuba, by God, Kennedy is surrounding Cuba day by day by day. There are more ships, more planes, more troops. And in fact, in spite of Homestead Air Force Base being in South Florida, the Strategic Air Command was taking over parts of Miami International Airport because there were no place to put the B-52s. Why are the B-52s important? They carry nuclear bombs. That was the primary instrument of nuclear delivery in 1962 on the U.S. side were the B-52s. And Miami International Airport had nice, big, long runways. So he sends a delegation to suggest to the Cubans that maybe we might want to put some nuclear weapons in. And what do you think? And we talked to Fidel Castro about this for 4 days at one of these critical oral history conferences in 1992. And Fidel, this is sort of how it went. So they ask us, would you like nuclear missiles? And we think, did he ask us if we wanted nuclear missiles? Us? Sure. Yeah. Hell yes. Great. Except, do you understand, Soviet colleagues, comrades, do you understand that, I mean, we're already a target. We're a proven target. They already invaded us last year. I mean, we're really going to be a target now. Yes, we know. But we have a plan, the Russians say. We're going to do it in secret. We're going to basically lie through our teeth to everybody all over the world. We're not even going to tell our diplomats. And then in November, Khrushchev is going to come to Cuba. And guess what? Fidel and Nikita will stand in front of the Jose Marti monument and they will proclaim Cuba as a nuclear power and that the Americans dare not mess with Cuba. Furthermore, this is Khrushchev's thinking. This is also called delusional thinking. Kennedy's going to like it. He's really going to like it because then we can begin to negotiate arms control on a basis of equality. Now, that is so far from reality, it makes you wonder who he was getting his information from. And it's important to realize at this point, Bob, that Khrushchev is in sole power in the Kremlin. This is the very height of his power. He consults only in a kind of perfunctory way. Everybody goes in, everybody raises their hand, everybody goes out, and they do what Nikita wants. Probably he couldn't have done this earlier, and he certainly couldn't have done it later. But the Cubans are amazed. I mean, it's the ultimate compliment. I mean, we're the new guys on the block, and they know that the Soviet Union has never put nuclear missiles anywhere but the USSR.
I'm talking about the 51st anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis with Professor James Blight. After the break, we'll hear more about the high-level discussions held in Washington and Moscow in October 1962.
The trip just gets deep.
The Cuban Missile Crisis and what was happening in Havana, Washington, and Moscow 51 years ago. On October 14, 1962, an American U-2 spy plane on a reconnaissance flight over western Cuba gathered the first photographic evidence of Soviet missile installations. 8 days later, congressional leaders saw the photos and President Kennedy addressed the nation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government has promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup
on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail.
You know, one of the interesting things about this event is that Khrushchev almost got away with it. It came very, very close because in the Caribbean, this is the storm season. This is the hurricane season. Cloud cover moved in over Cuba. U-2s flying at 75,000 feet could see nothing. And so for days and even for several weeks off and on, they couldn't get decent intelligence, aerial intelligence, of what was going on in Cuba. Now, there's something else to be said here, which is that they had a lot of on-the-ground intelligence because, I mean, Fidel had a lot of his Cubans in Miami telling him what the CIA maybe was up to, and likewise, the U.S. government had a lot of spies in Cuba. It's really interesting to note that the CIA, the Anglo handlers of the Cubans that were infiltrating the island, they would bring back what turns out to be absolutely pinpoint information about missiles that are this long and particular kinds of equipment that should have rung all the bells, but they discounted it. You can't trust the Cubans. We don't know if they're Cubans or our Cubans. So all we can really trust is the technology. But unfortunately, the technology was flying too high to take the pictures. So on the 14th, the critical pictures finally are taken because the cloud cover lifts for a bit. 15th, they're analyzed. 16th, Kennedy finds out, and they call the first meeting of his group later that morning.
Now, who were the other hawks and doves? What about McNamara? What about Dean Rusk? What about the president's kitchen cabinet?
Yeah. Kennedy's reaction, 11:30 a.m., October 16th, 1962. Kennedy, just before lunch, he says, we're going to talk about three things this afternoon. The first thing we're going to talk about is the thing I know we're going to do, and that's bomb the missile sites. The second thing we're going to have to discuss is that going to be enough, or do we have to bomb all the Soviet installations all over the island? That's the second thing. And the third thing is that going to be enough, or are we going to have to mount a full land, sea, and air invasion of the island of Cuba? So, have a good lunch, but we're going to war tonight, and it's a question of what kind of war we're going to. I'll see you in a couple hours. They come back, and what you get is, this is totally polarizing. The hawks become more hawkish, doves become more. And Kennedy immediately says, when they come back, I think we should ask what the Soviet reaction would be to any of these acts. And that puts the brakes on everything. And it's at that point, I really believe at that point, that he begins to invest heavily in McNamara. McNamara is going to have to manage these guys over at the Pentagon. He knows what these guys want to do. They want to go for it. They can't believe we didn't go for it in 1961 when they had a chance at the Bay of Pigs. And the Navy is waiting 2 miles offshore, and somehow or other this president of ours said, no, afraid of escalation. Well, he's doing it again. Well, McNamara's going to have to manage them. So basically, whenever Kennedy leaves the room, and he leaves the room a lot because he wants a conversation to go on without him there, and then he wants to know what they said. And it's usually McNamara who, with his, you know, he's like a bull in a china shop, says, I'm in charge now, and he pounds his left fist down, and everybody kind of backs off. And then they line up the options, McNamara style, and then the president comes in, and then McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, says, well, we have a range of views. We have some people who think we need to go in, and some people, so on and so forth. So it goes on like this for 6 days, and the secret was kept.
On October 27, 1962, known as Black Saturday, an American U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba, killing the pilot, Major Rudolph Anderson. Professor James Blight says that 12th day of the Cuban Missile Crisis was as close as the United States and the Soviet Union would come to outright war with each other.
when word got back in the mid-afternoon to the XCOM, many of the people said, oh, that the war's begun. We know that the Soviets are in charge of the surface-to-air missiles, the only kind that can shoot the U-2s down at that height. That must mean Khrushchev wants... It's unbelievable, but it seems like he's ready to escalate. He's going to push this all the way to the limit. He's ready to go to war over Cuba, and I think we have to prepare to go to war over Cuba. And what that meant in the context of the time almost certainly was we have to strike first. Otherwise, there's no chance of surviving this. If we strike first, and we're lucky, and we hit most of the targets, it may disarm the Soviet Union and what was then called by Curtis LeMay a disarming first strike or a splendid first strike. So within a matter of minutes after learning that this single spy plane had been shot down over Cuba, people are actually talking about going to war with the Soviet Union. You can hear that they're confused. McNamara says, wait a minute. I have a list here of 12 or maybe 13 things we can do short of going to war. Let's try a few of these. I don't think we should jump into this. I don't think we'll be able to control it. Other people are saying, oh, no, come on. What more evidence do you need than a dead American serviceman? We can't even send our reconnaissance people over Cuba because they're unarmed and they're going to get shot down increasingly. Furthermore, and this is one of the trigger points or tipping points, I think, the cloud cover moved back in, and Kennedy, after the 22nd, during that week leading up to the 27th, is sending in every day dozens and dozens of pairs of these F-8 Vought Crusaders flying 600 miles an hour at 50 feet off the ground, fitted out with these amazing cameras that take high-resolution pictures. And what this looks like on the ground is a totally different story. These are planes that make buildings explode. These are planes that blow out windows. And the Soviets have told the Cubans, you may not shoot at them. I know you got your guns out there. You guys have got the guns that hit the low-level planes, but don't use them because the damn war could start. And the Cuban reaction is, it started. The war's been going on for months. I mean, cut it out. So Castro goes out on the afternoon of the 26th. Two of these planes fly over. He looks at his crew. He goes right back to his headquarters and said, screw the Russians. Shoot them down. I want everything that you can hit. I want it down. I want all these planes down. And it was like a contagion all across the island. People are cheering and celebrating when they hear that this U-2 has been brought down. Now, it's true that the Russians brought it down, but the reason that happened is that the Cubans said to the Russians, are you going to play this game or aren't you? Are you going to get off your hands and shoot these guys? Or what are you going to, you're going to be just as dead as we are, aren't you? Well, it was contagious. I mean, they finally felt a kind of sense of empowerment that they had lost because these low-level planes are so fast, so loud, and so humiliating to them. So we get to the 27th. One of the planes is shot down. The Americans are thinking that Khrushchev wants to go to war. Khrushchev is thinking, wow, Khrushchev knows what Kennedy's thinking. He's thinking, I'm thinking, I want to go to war. Holy cow, no. Well, final piece of the puzzle, Fidel Castro. Late in the evening, it's actually early in the morning of the 27th. It begins at 3 a.m. and it ends at 7 a.m. He goes into a bunker underneath the Soviet embassy, the bomb shelter, with the Soviet ambassador Alexander Alexeyev. Castro says, I have to write one more letter to Comrade Nikita, and I need your help working it out. Castro obviously didn't speak Russian. Alexeyev spoke pretty good Spanish, but they had another interpreter there. They go through 10 drafts. And Castro is really getting aggravated. He can't quite say what he wants. Finally, Alexeyev says to him, these are in his cables, which we now have, Alexeyev's cables, are you saying that you want us to attack the United States of America with nuclear weapons? Is that what you're asking? Castro says, yes, but not exactly, not quite. If, he says, if they attack us, and invade us, and occupy us. And then he says, I know this one by heart. That would be the moment to eliminate this danger forever, for there is no other solution. Alexeyev goes out to a side room while Castro is fuming and fussing over a draft. He then sends a message on the KGB channel. It goes immediately to Khrushchev, and it says, in case you're confused about what this letter is saying that's about to be sent, what it says is, wipe them off the face of the earth. That is his request. That is a suicide request. That is the last request of a man who is more than willing to take his 6.5 million countrymen down with him, because this will be the moment to eliminate the United States Empire forever.
And Khrushchev thought, no, I don't think so.
Khrushchev, when this is, he's in a tense meeting, a guy comes to the door and says, something just came in from Fidel. And then he reads the thing from Alexeyev, wipe them off the face of the earth. Khrushchev stands straight up in his chair and shouts, this is insane. Fidel is trying to drag us with him into the grave. He wants to die beautifully, and he wants us to die beautifully right along with him. Okay, this is what we're going to do. The missiles are coming out. Nobody does anything on the island of Cuba unless my signature is on the piece of paper that orders it. We are done, finished, out of here. That's it. That moment is so tense that it's easy to imagine one plane being shot down, one more plane, one low flyer, one U-2, because they're still flying over the island. What happens if one or two of those planes come down? I think they have to respond. They're going to either have to stop the flights and not know whether these missiles are operational, which is not acceptable, or they're going to have to bomb the crap out of them, because they can't, in good conscience, send in unarmed photographic planes knowing that the enemy is trying to shoot them down. And that's totally unacceptable. So the war could have started at any moment, probably in a 12-hour period between late Saturday the 27th and early Sunday the 28th.
How is this, or is this, remembered in Cuba? Is it taught in schools?
Yeah, it's called the October Crisis. The older generation of Cubans thinks of this as almost some kind of primal moment. There are pieces of the U-2 that was shot down all over the island, and the chunks of it are in these little circular gravel pits that have a little kind of border around them. They're sort of like religious relics, and they prove to the Cubans that we are on our own, and we don't mind being on our own, and we can protect ourselves. So, Yankees, just listen up. Just one last point on this. The first time my wife Janet and I were ever in Cuba was in 1989. We went to see the main carcass of the U-2, which is the second holiest relic in Cuba after the Granma, the ship that Castro and his colleagues came from Mexico on in 1955. We stepped back because a bunch of school children approached. A teacher is giving a lecture and keeps pointing to this metal object over here. And at one point, this was really spooky, because she put her fist in the air, and all these students put their little tiny fists in the air, and they shouted, Patria o muerte, fatherland or death. And I thought, whoa, 8 years old, and they're already getting ready for another one of these ultimate confrontations.
Thank you very much.
Now, do you understand what I keep telling you about the psychopaths at the top? All major power players are psychopaths, and they will play around with the destiny of the whole world, and they can't be trusted. So what are you going to do about it? I don't know for sure. But it's pretty scary, isn't it? We almost did it back then. I knew guys that were on the ships that were sailing down there to Cuba ready to go. I knew guys that were on the ships lying off the coast at the Bay of Pigs that they wouldn't allow to back up the Cuban nationals from overthrowing Castro. It was a hell of a mess. Well, that's it for today. Just remember, no major power leader can be trusted with the future of the world. I'll be back tomorrow.